Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He discusses the recently announced initiative at HHS to make everyone's electronic medical records readily available to them on their smartphones at no cost to the patient. They're seeking true portability of one's own health information. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with the National Coordinator for Health IT at HHS, Dr. Donald Rucker, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Prior to joining ONC, Dr. Rucker was Clinical Professor of Emergency Medicine and Biomedical Informatics at Ohio State University. He began his informatic career at DataMedic Corporation, where he developed the world's first Microsoft Windows-based electronic medical record. He earned his undergraduate degree at Harvard, his medical degree from UPenn, and his MBA and MS in medical computer science from Stanford. Dr. Rucker, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks.
ONC's job is to build a private and secure nationwide health information system that supports meaningful use of health data. And you just recently, I think at the HIMSS conference, shared some exciting new bold initiatives that have come out of the Secretary's office, Secretary Azar, and chief among them is a proposed rule to support seamless and secure exchange and use of electronic health information by giving patients and their healthcare providers secure access to health information. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners about the new rule and what you think is very significant about this exciting new direction.
Sure. What we're doing and proposing as a rule, it's out for public comment, is to actually allow patients to get their medical records on their smartphone. So if you think about it, in the last couple of years, you know, we've allowed patients to get access to their data through patient portals, right? But we haven't really allowed patients to control their data, taking it, moving it somewhere else. It really has not been possible in a practical way that sort of reflects our daily realities. And so we're really putting the medical record into that consumer space where we live, right? Where we, you know, do whatever it is, Uber or Lyft or banking or airline reservations type of thing. This rule requires providers to actually have a URL endpoint, the browser address that patients can download their medical record securely using standards-based application programming interfaces. That's a lot of technical jargon. It means you can take an app of your choice that ingests medical records, point it at your provider, and get your data on your smartphone. Pretty exciting.
That is pretty exciting. And, you know, Don, it reminds me of so many things in healthcare over the last decade or so where all of us in healthcare go, wow, that's amazing and revolutionary. And the patients go, what took you so long to figure out that this is? But we know, of course, there are concerns and complications. And I understand that the rules still leave some unanswered questions as to the how, of course, how we make all this health data seamlessly accessible to all patients and at no cost to them. And I say that that's remarkable because that's such a far cry from what we see today, where patients seeking access to their information often find out they have to come in person and sign a release. There's a longstanding tradition of allowing providers to charge. Tell me what Congress defined as information blocking. What's the vision around that?
One of the things that you pointed out, with modern application programming interfaces, we have a whole set of technical opportunities to do this much more readily than we have in the past. Congress has heard a lot of complaints exactly along the lines you outlined, Margaret. You know, providers don't want to provide the data. So in the law now, the law being the 21st Century Cures Act, signed into law by President Obama. I assure you the White House are absolutely on top of, you know, enforcing this access for patients.
Great.
It is prohibited for providers to do what's called information blocking, you know, to not provide you with your medical data electronically. We were asked at the Office of the National Coordinator, again, part of Health and Human Services, to define allowable exceptions. The baseline assumption is providers will provide the data to patients electronically through these endpoints. So you can download it on your smartphone. Once it's on your smartphone, you can do with it as you desire. But the exceptions, so we've crafted out for proposed rulemaking some things around privacy, security, potential patient harm. This would probably be, you know, with underlying mental illness type of issues. Then also some technical allowances on what the EMR vendors can charge the providers who have to provide these application programming interfaces, as well as some common sense provisions. The computer request can't be acted on, you know, that's an exception, or, you know, if the server is being rebooted. But the base assumption is that providers, so doctors and hospitals, through their EMRs are going to provide an endpoint that an app of your choosing will be able to download your medical record.
Well, that is just exciting news, I think, for everybody,
absolutely.
All consumers listening. I think we live in this world of worries about hacking and cybersecurity and the like, and that platform might be one that's vulnerable. To what extent are you working with the companies or making sure we're going to put it into an environment that's safe and secure and works for the patient?
Yeah, so whenever you hear something about cybersecurity, you sort of really dig into what exactly is the issue. You know, is this just somebody hijacking a password? Is this a deep vulnerability in the software because of a bug? Or is this something that where we've actually consented to allow the data to be reused, right? So the Facebook type of Google type of questions. So when you look at for the patient record on the smartphone, the technical stuff is quite secure under something called OAuth2. That's a, you know, a nerd alert term for the encryption security protocol. It's the same thing that's used by banks, you know, with your financial data. So we're using state-of-the-art security there, and patients have to give consent. It's actually very similar to the type of security that's used today if you log on to a patient portal from your provider, but it's actually more empowering to the patients because they actually can revoke consent, you know, they can control it. So it's actually a much more empowering thing for the patient. Then patients, I think, will have to make an assessment of what apps they use to hold their medical data, just the same way you decide, you know, do I want to use a banking app? You have to sort of figure out, is this an operation that I trust? And people will make that determination. It'll be under their control which apps they store their data on or use to access their data. But they will have to, as with every other choice they make on their smartphone, think about what are the privacy implications here, right? Of course, we give up lots of privacy. You know, anybody who uses Facebook, anybody who uses Google, anybody who uses a credit card, right? We've already made many choices where we've said, you know what, we understand they have our data, and, you know, we want that convenience. I think different patients will draw that line in different places depending on their, you know, clinical issues, the opportunities for the smartphone to give them better ways of treatment, new ways of treatment. I think the biggest issue in all of this that is often underlying interoperability is so much healthcare is unaffordable in America. So many people have massive issues affording healthcare. And so one of the big benefits here is to inject competition into healthcare delivery systems that have often configured themselves to prevent patients from taking their data and shopping.
Interesting.
So I think all of that will come into, you know, the patient side of what they do with their data.
Great.
But the technical side is secure.
I hadn't thought about that patient sort of comparison in shopping. But I wonder if I can go back to the information blocking piece for a moment.
Sure.
My understanding is that the team at ONC has actually proposed 7 exceptions where the patient or another provider might request health information and the request can be denied. I wonder if you would tell us what the other exceptions are. And I'd also love it if you could comment on, did you within ONC convene any kind of focus groups of consumers or get any feedback on what those exceptions ought to be?
So the exceptions, again, I think the exceptions, I would look at them as fairly narrow and fairly specific. The baseline assumption is the providers are going to release the data to patients and that the patients are in control. I think for too long, the American medical establishment has been extremely paternalistic. You know, we've all grown up with other people deciding the health care we get since the start of Medicare and maybe even the World War II provisions around having health insurance. And so patients can't decide. They're not smart enough to have their data. I don't buy into that at all. It's just not true, and it's not right. So the exceptions are designed to be narrow. The specific exceptions are if there's something where we think there would be harm coming to a patient or another person, you know, this would be very, very narrow, I would think. The second exception is something where we think that the release of the information would violate privacy. Again, with all these exceptions, it can't just be like a blanket excuse.
Yeah.
There have to be very specific. The other exceptions are security, very similar to privacy. In terms of costs, obviously interfaces, software, access, all of this costs money, but we've heard a lot of complaints. We've actually met with many, many folks in putting these rules together, in particular with a lot of entrepreneurial firms, you know, that would like to provide new services to the American public, often at much lower cost. And we hear that the, you know, vendor community often is charging $1 million for them to have access to the data, you know, charges that bear no relationship. You can obviously price an API out of existence. So you're only allowed to charge reasonably incurred costs. And there's also a second provision of the 7. If you're claiming intellectual property, that you have to license it on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. We've heard complaints that these APIs are only opened up if the vendor feels that this might want to compete in this line of business, and then they won't let this competitor have access to the data. And then the final 2 of the 7, because think about feasibility, an app is going to an endpoint and asking for something, well, you know, demands could be infinite, right? So, you know, it has to be something that can actually be provided. And then finally, if there's, you know, downtime, these are servers, you know, as we all know, computers need to be rebooted, those types of things. So those are the 7 exceptions to information blocking. We think it's going to free up the information for patients.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which is tasked with building a private and secure nationwide health information system. You know, Don, it's kind of an exciting new era that we're going into. And I think one of the things that we've heard from our patients is that they're smart, but the information tends to be boring and not in context. And I'm wondering what's going to happen in terms of the entrepreneurial aspect of Facebook. But really, a lot of people are sharing information regularly. I take it what might be occurring is that they have an app that they've developed. It may be one where they're sharing it with a whole community of people. It may be a community of their family and friends that we're going to see the entrepreneurs thinking about ways that if you want to slice and dice this or you can parse something off and send it off to one of your relatives, you're going to be free to do that. When you talk about sitting with those entrepreneurial organizations, are you hearing people starting to discuss this development as well?
Yeah, you know, Mark, those are going to be some of the things, and we've already seen some of these from obviously a number of small companies, and Apple obviously is a large company that have, you know, done that first step. And as you point out, you know, it can be pretty dry. But mm-hmm. I think the real win is going to be in, you know, what I think in the software world is called a mashup. Mm-hmm. And right now, if you look at the app, and I don't know, I've heard numbers of 200,000 health apps. I have no idea. I haven't done
a lot.
Personal count. But if you look at that app universe, you find there's a very small handful that have access to medical data. And then there's a whole other set of apps about health that have no access to medical data. Mm-hmm. You know, fitness apps, diet apps. I think the win and the entrepreneurial is going to be when people figure out new ways to blend streams of information to come up with entirely new products. And let me go back to the ride-sharing services. So if you dissect out Uber or Lyft, think about all the different things that they've mashed into that service, right? So they've put in APIs to mapping, to credit card, to traffic, to your consumer database, probably 10 other things under the covers, right? So the win is they've taken a bunch of things that before were not connectable, right? In the old days, if you wanted a cab, if you could even find one, you know, you'd call a dispatcher. You never know when they were coming. Right. We're in that old school era where, you know, your stuff is sort of just locked in the chart. I think it's going to be tremendously exciting.
Yes.
It's going to play out over the years. Mm-hmm. And the winners here will be combinations that, you know, the three of us on this phone call won't have ever even dreamed of.
That's true.
Well, that's a very exciting future. And, you know, we'll do one nod to the past, Mark, I think, and say that we have enjoyed learning from, talking to your predecessors at HHS and ONC, and that have worked so long and hard to get us to this point.
A font of creativity.
Really. So I just want to take a moment mm-hmm. and really celebrate all those people.
Absolutely. Yes. My predecessors have laid the foundation for this. It's taken a number of years.
It absolutely has. And, you know, one of our favorite lines that came out of the almost two decades of this was Todd Parks and his liberate the data. Liberate the data for a lot of different purposes. But one of them absolutely was for the possibility of research to have, you know, data sets that we never dreamed possible to think about ways to improve health, prevent disease, promote well-being. How does this most recent direction increase access to data for research purposes? And are you excited about that dimension as well?
You know, I think this is one of the things that the new technology has opened up, and some other work we're doing at ONC with the National Institute of Health on Sync for Science and Sync for Genes, where we're using these modern APIs to hook up patient records for research, allow patients to participate in these research trials. It's very exciting, right? Of course, the patients who are most interested are the patients with, you know, major illness, for whom this opens up some real possibilities for new treatments that would actually change their life in just stunning ways. The beauty of the technology here of these FHIR, Fast Healthcare Interoperable Resource type of application programming interfaces is that we can broaden the entire research pool of data. Historically, research has been these heavily controlled clinical trials where they've used a lot of statistical work with a small number of patients mm-hmm. to extrapolate to the rest of us. That's expensive. It often doesn't include, you know, minorities mm-hmm. or people who are older right. or younger or have a different genetic makeup. So we think this is going to allow us to rethink the enterprise. Interestingly enough, this open application programming interface part is part of the 21st Century Cures Act that also rethinks how the FDA handles data. Uh-huh. So it's really in harmony.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. You can learn more about this new proposed rules and are invited to submit comments mm-hmm. on the rule by going to healthit.gov, or you can follow them on Twitter at @ONC_HealthIT. Don, thank you. And as Margaret said, thank your team for the contributions that you're making and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Mark, Margaret, thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In a February town hall event on CNN, presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders repeated a few claims about health care that we've debunked before. Sanders said that President Trump sought to, quote, throw 32 million people off of the health care they had. But that figure includes some who would choose to no longer purchase insurance if the individual mandate penalty were removed, which occurred this year. The figure Sanders cites is a government estimate of what would happen if Congress repealed the Affordable Care Act without replacing it. President Trump supported the Republican-backed American Health Care Act, a bill that sought partial repeal and replacement of the ACA. But when that plan faltered, he also advocated for an immediate repeal of the ACA with a replacement at a later date. A 2017 analysis by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which fits that replace later strategy, did find that approach would increase the number of uninsured by 32 million people over 10 years. But not all of them would be thrown off their insurance, as Sanders said. Sanders also claimed the U.S. is spending, quote, almost twice as much per capita on health care as any other country. Estimates do show the U.S. spends almost double what many other countries do, but not all of them. The U.S. spent $10,209 per capita in 2017. That's more than double the 2017 OECD average of $4,069 per capita. However, Switzerland spent $8,009 per capita, and Norway spent $6,351 per capita. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Stanford-based bioengineer Manu Prakash has a simple goal. He wants to create a portable medical lab small enough to fit in a backpack, and he's already developed a tool that fits the bill. While sitting under a tree in Uganda, he noticed that the local medical clinic's door was propped open by an expensive centrifuge machine, one that was reliant on electricity, now broken and no longer in use. And he wondered, how could he create a portable centrifuge that would be inexpensive to make, easy to operate, and easy to replace? His inspiration came from a simple childhood toy, the Whirligig, a toy that functions by pulling two ends of a string threaded through a round object like a button.
So we spent a significant portion of this time truly understanding the mathematical phase space for how you can convert linear motion into rotational motion.
So he took this simple toy idea to another level, creating a human-powered centrifuge made from simple components. Paper, twine, and plastic. Altogether, each paperfuge, as he calls it, can be constructed in under 2 minutes and costs only 20 cents. And yet, remarkably, it works extremely efficiently.
With this set of principles, we're able to essentially make a centrifuge that spins all the way to 120,000 RPM. In the lab, we can separate and pull out malaria parasites from blood, separate blood plasma.
It's currently being tested for malaria diagnoses, but is being readied for far more complex diagnostic challenges.
This is a tool that requires no electricity. You can carry them around in your pockets for a price point of 20 cents.
The paperfuge, a cheap but highly effective field tool for clinicians, providing a portable solution to diagnostic challenges. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.